20 years ago tomorrow, Sally Ride became the first U.S. woman in space on board the Shuttle Challenger.
We go for main engine start. We have main engine start and ignition and liftoff. Liftoff of STS-7 and America's first woman astronaut.
That milestone was preceded by a secret program in 1961 to test women pilots for spaceflight. 13 women endured and passed a battery of grueling physical tests. These were the same tests that the Mercury 7 astronauts, including John Glenn and Alan Shepard, underwent at the Lovelace Foundation in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The names of the women pilots and would-be astronauts, among them Jerry Cobb, Wally Funk, Myrtle Cagle, Bea Stedman, are largely lost to history. The story of their secret testing and the ultimate scrapping of the program is told in a new book by Martha Ackman, titled The Mercury 13.
The women were sworn to secrecy, and because they wanted to go so badly, they really did hold to that. They didn't tell anyone. And indeed, one of the women, Rhea Hurley Allison, never told her family, and she said, well, I just expected them to find out when I became an astronaut. And that's another point. They all expected to become astronauts, and they all felt that they were good enough.
These women were supposed to go on to testing in Pensacola, Florida, more simulation testing. Some of them actually quit their jobs so that they could be there for those tests. And then that program was abruptly canceled. What happened?
In Pensacola, the women were to go through spaceflight simulation tests, and they needed special equipment. They needed only the equipment that, at that time, naval aviation had. The Navy then felt that it needed a green light from NASA. So they contacted NASA, and they said, is this an officially sponsored NASA program? And NASA, at that point, said no. They viewed it as Randy Lovelace, a NASA consultant, and certainly the man who helped select John Glenn and the rest. They viewed this project as his independent experiment. So they shut the program down. They did not give the green light, and that ended that phase. It was at that point that the medical and scientific question that the women were trying to answer became a political one, whether they had the right to become astronauts.
Mm-hmm. And this becomes a very public debate, it seems, in the early 1960s. You talk about a columnist for the Dallas Times-Herald.
Yes.
Relating a mock conversation of women astronauts on board a spacecraft. The little thingamabob has jiggled off the gizmo.
Oh, right. Just that women didn't have any idea about how to function in a cockpit. And that particular article was even accompanied by a cartoon that showed a Mercury 7 space capsule with tieback curtains inside and ringed with garlands and flowers called Geranium 7.
And Lyndon Johnson, at the time vice president, is looking at that spacecraft with some degree of horror. He is at
Yes.
the center of this discussion because he is the president's liaison with NASA. And Jerry Cobb and Janie Hart, another one of the Mercury 13, get a meeting with him. And they're asking him to make this happen, to get women astronauts back on track.
That's right. Cobb and Hart went into the meeting and explained to him that they had passed the same medical tests at the Lovelace Clinic in Albuquerque. They talked about tests in isolation. They presented a whole list of points about why women should be considered. Women weighed less. They used less oxygen. They required less food. This is a time when one of the great debates about space was that the United States had trouble lifting a capsule into space. So every pound literally counted. They made their appeal to LBJ, and they reported that he listened quite sincerely. He then sort of threw his hands up in the air and said, you know, I'd love to help, but it's really up to James Webb, the head of NASA, to make this decision. They thanked the vice president, were disappointed, and left the meeting. But what they didn't know at the time was that there was a letter that had been drafted for the vice president's signature, a letter asking the question, is there any reason why women can't be astronauts? And at the bottom of that letter, LBJ had penned the words, let's stop this now.
It's ultimately the Soviets who first launch a woman into space. This is June 16th, 1963, 40 years ago. And you find a headline in a local paper about Jerry Cobb's reaction to this, which I love. Space-bitten U.S. gal chagrined.
Yes, Jerry Cobb certainly wanted to be the woman on the launch pad to become the first woman in space. And I think while she was delighted that a woman had finally been able to go into space, she certainly, in this heat of the space race with the Soviet Union in the early 60s, had hoped that it would be a United States woman. And she certainly hoped it would be Jerry Cobb.
You describe a scene in July of 1999 when 8 members of the original Mercury 13 go to Cape Canaveral to see Eileen Collins become the first female commander of a shuttle mission.
Yes, pilots call it sitting in left seat, being the person in charge, driving the bus. While the Mercury 13 certainly were thrilled when Sally Ride became the first U.S. female astronaut in 1983, when Collins became the first commander, the first woman to pilot the space shuttle, they were just enormously thrilled.
What was that like? What was their reaction as they watched her taking off in that position that maybe they thought once a long time ago that they might be doing?
They were so proud of Eileen Collins. I think it was a mixture of pride and disappointment. I was sitting next to Wally Funk during one of the first attempts to launch. It actually took 3 days for the weather to clear and the flight to go up. But at T-minus 6 seconds, Wally Funk's body tensed and she looked straight ahead at the shuttle and she said, "Go, Eileen, go for all of us."
There's a moment when the mission is aborted at T-minus 6 seconds, and you describe a teenager sitting in the stands, sort of throwing up his hands in dismay, saying, "T-minus 6 seconds."
And one of the T-minus 6 seconds, right. And Jerry Sloan Truhill was sitting next to her testing partner, Bea Stedman, and she turned to her and looked with a sort of a wink in her eye and said, "Try T-minus 38 years." Their time had been a long one in coming.
At the end of this project, did you come away with the feeling that women back in the early 1960s were ready to become part of the astronaut program? Or do you think maybe they were just a bit ahead of their time and that things needed to run their course?
I think that they were ready. The barrier that ultimately existed was that Congress declared that all astronauts had to come from the ranks of military jet test pilots. But it was a catch-22 because women were not allowed to be military pilots and certainly not military jet test pilots. So that was what ultimately kept them back. But had they been able to get that, I think they definitely were ready to become astronauts. And another theme that came over again and again in my conversations with the Mercury 13 is that they wanted to become involved because they felt they had something to contribute. Here were women who wanted to live large, who were willing to give their talents and their energy. And for some, they told me they were willing to give their lives to this project, to have this opportunity. So it was the loss of that contribution, the country's loss of that contribution, which is, I think, the saddest part of this whole story and perhaps its greatest lesson.
Martha Ackman, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
Martha Ackman teaches women's studies at Mount Holyoke College. Her new book is called The Mercury 13, The Untold Story of 13 American Women and the Dream of Spaceflight.